Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. Good to be here.
And today we're going to do another kind of quick fire Q&A episode, responding to some of the questions you've been sending in. Just a reminder, we love to read your thoughts, your feedback, suggestions, disagreements, always welcome. Please do email us, molad@premier.org.uk. But to start with, this question caught my eye for obvious reasons. This is coming in from a listener called Joan, and she says this: these past few years, I'll admit that I've become very skeptical about journalism in general. I'm not convinced that most journalists are necessarily interested in uncovering the truth and reporting what they find in an unbiased way. I fear that media kingdoms, such as the one owned by Murdoch, are far more interested in selling their point of view and maintaining stock market value than in telling the truth. Even Christian media, especially in the States, has been caught up in so many conspiracy theories of all kinds that I hesitate to trust any of them. Here's my question: how does one find or choose a news source that is politically unaligned and that is seeking to present the facts in an unbiased manner and simply present the truth? I've got lots of views, as you'd expect, on this, but I'm going to ping to you first, Dad, just to have you do your take, and then I'll come in with my own kind of journalism perspective.
I mean, it's such a fascinating topic, and I think what is generally understood is that a free press, free journalism, investigative journalism that is able to speak truth to power, to use that hackneyed phrase, is actually one of the often unrecognized bedrocks of a healthy democracy. You know, the only way that the electorate, that the citizenship can know what is really going on, especially with the powerful in their society, pretty well the only way is through a really healthy journalistic enterprise. And without that, without a free press, without journalists with integrity and with courage, prepared to take risks and so on in order to tell the truth, democracy is impossible. And you know, I think we are seeing across the world, aren't we? You know, from my perspective, a kind of attacks on free press. And this is particularly said to be happening in some of those big, supposedly democratic countries like India, China, Russia, and in many other countries where it's increasingly impossible to have for journalists to have any kind of freedom to tell the truth about their political masters. So I'm deeply concerned about this. I think the problem that I see it from looking in from the outside is that this understanding of the centrality of a free press is not widely recognized or is not appreciated enough. And I suspect particularly by the younger generation. And therefore, I think there is this this feeling that, you know, if I get my news through TikTok, if I get my news on my social media phase, if I get it by doing a Google search, that's fine. You know, why do I need to spend money to pay for news? So this understanding that genuine freedom, free press is an essential part of democracy. I think that my sense is that that is being lost. And therefore, I fear that your profession, Tim, is under great threat. And of course, the next big thing that's coming along is AI journalism. And the idea that, and it's already starting, isn't it, of AI-based news outlets. Who needs human beings? We just get the algorithms and they'll tell us what's going on.
I mean, this is a kind of side note, but I was literally talking to another journalist just a few weeks ago who was saying that they had been doing some kind of freelance work, a kind of mixture of kind of copywriting and other kind of writing jobs. And the company they have been working for many years doing this, they would interview people and write it up in a certain way, is now saying, oh, we're now offering our clients the chance to go for a half price package where the AI writes it and then the human being just does a light edit at the end to make sure it's good. Is that all right? As a result, we'll be halving your pay as well. So this is a very much a reality. But anyway, terrifying reality for me. I think Joan's question, I mean, I agree with everything you say about the value of the free press for obvious reasons and its kind of declining salience among people's minds. But what is interesting to me about Joan's question is it's not necessarily about the freedom of the press, but about the quality of the press. That you know, in America, for example, the example she uses is kind of Fox News and the Murdoch empire. The press is pretty much still pretty free. I mean, anyone can go into the States, start a newspaper and write in the newspaper anything they like, and the government will almost entirely leave you alone. But the problem is that the press is no longer trustworthy or is perceived to be biased and to be partisan. And so you have these free independent media groups, large media groups, such as the Murdoch one, but not exclusively, which have a perception among some, like Joan, that they are, rather than seeking to speak truth to power and challenge injustice and report truthfully and fairly so that the educated citizenry have their chance to make up their own mind, they're actually simply kind of an extension of an entertainment industry that is seeking to perpetuate their own stock market value and bottom line, and in perpetuating the point of view of their ownership, irrespective of what the truth is. And that's, there's actually been a proliferation of media in the States. You know, there are more TV channels and online news outlets now than there have ever been in the history of the States. There's no lack of a free media. The problem is that all these new media that have been created, particularly in the kind of Trump era, have been created purely to serve narrow slices of the population, feeding them untruths, irrespective of the real world reality that kind of scratch their itch. You know, so there are, you know, Fox News has been outflanked on the right by multiple hyper-partisan, super right-wing news channels that are seeking to peel away the Fox News viewership, the Republican pro-Trump viewership. And in doing so, they genuinely don't care if they lie or not. They just tell absolute factual objective untruths every single day, every hour, and it's hugely commercially successful. And that is Joan's fear, and something I generally share, that actually the bigger threat for journalism in countries such as the US and potentially the UK is not that the government turns authoritarian and starts, you know, imposing censorship, but is that all media is driven by either commercial or partisan political concerns, and you no longer have that kind of neutral, impartial journalism that is simply unaligned politically and seeking the truth. Is that something that would worry you as well?
Yeah, it is, and it's not just on the right wing as well, because you know, I think when you read some of the very well known left leaning. Newspapers and media outlets, as I do quite regularly, I also perceive a kind of constant banging on certain themes. And whereas I think it's less overt in terms of just telling outright lies, there's a very strong slant, a very strong media bias spectacles which are implied. So I do see it as very difficult. It's interesting, just speaking personally, I am fascinated by the rise of things like Substack and other independent or relatively independent sources, which are where journalists are basically taking them, going independent. And what you do is you find someone you trust and who has a track record and apparent authenticity. And you say, I trust that individual. I no longer trust whatever it is, the Guardian newspaper, Fox News, to give me consistently reliable, honest, balanced truth. But actually, here's an individual who has authenticity, and I will trust him. And if necessary, what happens in Substack is that you pay, sometimes you can, you have the option of paying a regular subscription. And some journalists, I understand, are now finding that this is a new business model. And I find this fascinating, that in other words, it's a kind of, we no longer trust institutions. We find institutions, whether even the BBC, even the New York Times, even whatever it is, we increasingly find it impossible to trust them, but we can trust individuals.
I mean, you're right. This is a massive trend in recent years. I should declare an interest. I am a freelance journalist who has recently started his own Substack newsletter. Do subscribe to that if you haven't already. You can find it at tswyatt.substack.com. It's called The Critical Friend. Comes out every week, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, you're right that there has been this fascinating trend, particularly in America, I've noticed, but increasingly in Britain, where famous, like name famous journalists have left their kind of long-standing kind of outlet stables, whether that is, as you say, the BBC or the Times, Telegraph, the New York Times, CNN, and strike out solo, saying, do you know what? I don't need an editor and the institution to promote me and distribute me. The distribution is taken care of for free by the power of the internet and Substack technology. And therefore, I can have a direct relationship with my readers. You each give me $5 a month. And there are people who are literally raking in millions of dollars in subscription revenue through Substack. A few, not many, obviously. Most of us are toiling at very small numbers underneath the bottom of that pyramid. But there are some people who have genuinely created kind of lifetime financial independence. Simply, they're doing the same thing they've always done, which is write news articles, or often in this case, kind of opinion and comment articles. But by cutting out the middleman of the newspaper or the broadcaster and setting up directly with their readers, they create this very tangible, trustworthy relationship, you know. And I think in one level, this is great. I'm involved in this. I'm doing the same thing. It's a new string to my bow in my own profession. I'm enjoying the kind of creative freedom, being able to write whatever I like week by week, cover different topics. But I also have concerns, because there's an obvious reason why it appeals to individual journalists, because it gives you total freedom. But actually, the strength and the power of an institution like a newspaper, a website, a news channel, is that you have a plurality of voices, and that your story is checked and edited and fact-checked by people from different political perspectives, people who aren't emotionally and personally invested in it, who can call out, you've made a mistake there, or you've gone in too hard on that person there, you're not being reasonable, or actually that's just inaccurate and untrue, you haven't read this study that completely disproves it. And I think there is real merit in doing journalism as a collaborative, collective effort. Even though for me, as the writer, it's often frustrating to have your work edited, I do have to concede it makes it better. And in particular, I think there is also real merit in the idea of, you know, a newspaper like the New York Times, or in this country, the Times, aspires to, in theory, they have their perspectives, but they inspire in theory to say, we're going to present different views to you. You know, on the news reporting pages, we'll cover stories from, you know, red states and blue states, and we'll cover issues that are of interest to the elderly, interest to the young. And then on the opinion pages, we'll have Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and progressives writing their own views. And it's created this kind of melange of opinion, which you as the consumer gets this package deal of a newspaper or in an app. Whereas if you're only getting your news from individuals that you've personally subscribed to, it's likely that you're going to be getting quite a partial, unfiltered, biased perspective, rather than at its best what a newspaper or news channel is trying to achieve is a more holistic, rounded, genuinely diverse kind of set of viewpoints that helps the listener, the reader, to draw their own conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that, and I'm sure you're actually right. I mean, two things. Number one, what's so interesting to me is that the old Enlightenment understanding of truth was a kind of mathematical understanding that truth was a kind of mathematical correspondence between an idea in my head and objective reality out there. And the closer the idea in my head became to objective reality, the more truthful it was. And the problem with this is that it doesn't work in the real world. And the biblical understanding of truth, it seems to me, is much more closely related to deciding who is trustworthy. Truth is what a trustworthy person tells you. And you can't get away from that. In other words, it's a human phenomenon. It depends on relationship. It depends on trust and on character and on authenticity. And, and of course, God is the one who is utterly trustworthy, and therefore we can trust what he says. And evil is fundamentally the lie, the liar. So therefore, I think this, you can't get away from questions of trust. You can't get away. And trust is ultimately in persons. When I trust an institution, who am I really trusting? I'm trusting the people who, I'm trusting the editor. Or am I trusting the board? Am I trusting the owners? Who? That's the problem, isn't it? The advantage of the Substack is that it makes it much clearer who I'm trusting. And I think if I'm going to use Substack or equivalent as my source of news, obviously I have to be wise and say, okay, well, I'm going to choose some different voices of people that I trust from different perspectives. So I'm going to try to expose myself not just to one very particular segment. And then the question I put back to you would be, okay, I can still hear what you're saying, that that investigative journalism works much better in a team with resources that can be provided and all the rest. But what's your solution? What's your solution to particularly to the American free enterprise version of news gathering?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. I don't have a particularly well-formed, robust policy solution to that. I think fundamentally the media will often, in a free society, will reflect the society itself. And the reason American media has become incredibly partisan, divisive, and in my view, consequently, like, less trustworthy, is because American society over the last 10 years has taken that trajectory, and the free enterprise media is following where the dollars are. And there used to be money in the 1970s, there was money to be made for the New York Times or for CBS News or whoever it is in being a kind of like centrist behemoth that just squatted in the middle of the country and said, we are going to offer news to everyone, whoever you are, from whatever perspective, wherever you vote, you all come and watch our nightly news broadcast. You all read our daily newspaper and it will serve everyone. And those institutions thrived. And today, what thrives and does well in a business landscape is the exact opposite. It's hyper-partisan, serving a small slice, but getting a lot of money from them by feeding them what they want to hear. I don't have a quick solution problem, because the solution to that is fundamentally, how do you solve social division in America, which is beyond the scope of me and this podcast. I think what I would say is, to push back on your earlier point, you're right that we trust people, but I actually think you can trust institutions. We have to be cautious about it, because obviously institutions are built by people. But I think about something like the BBC. It's far from a perfect news organization. I've read things on there that I think that's not great. I will freely concede that it has its flaws. It has a bias, mostly an unintentional one driven by the types of people who choose to work for the BBC. I think it's better than most at not having a kind of proprietorial institutional level bias. If anything, it's kind of maybe towards the existing establishment, the kind of default. It has a kind of political inertia. But the reason I trust the BBC, almost irrespective of what particular byline name is on the article or which particular producer has put this package together on this 10 o'clock news, is because I trust their standards and their values, and that the people who, and that there are good people behind the scenes, the institution upholding basic standards of fairness, impartiality, due accuracy, you know, the right to comment, having everything confirmed by a second source before you publish. Like, I know that there are people behind the scenes baked into this institution who are upholding those standards. And as a result, I trust more the output of something that has the BBC brand on it, irrespective of which individual concerned is doing the journalism, because I believe in the institution. I'm not saying everyone should necessarily follow me in believing in that institution. And there are other institutions that I believe in. But I think I would push back and say, it's not true that you only can trust individuals. You can also trust institutions if you think that institution is being rooted on a good foundation. And that's fundamentally what I say to people when they ask this question. Like, there is no shortcut. I'm not going to give you a kind of secret way. This is how you find good journalism. We have to just become very critical consumers of the news, and we need to, you know, go and understand the difference between The Guardian, The Telegraph, and The Times, or CNN versus Fox News. And everything we watch, even so-called impartial, like the BBC News, has to be engaged with in a kind of wise manner. And that's the only way. There isn't a one neat trick to finding trustworthy journalism. It's about becoming highly news literate, understanding how the media works, what the political pressures are, what is driving which paper, who owns which paper and which media group, and where their sympathies lie, and then reading everything through the lens of that and weighing it as seems best, and you know, making judgment calls. That's the only way, really, as far as I can see.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
One more question from a listener, a completely different issue. This is Robert wrote in to say that he had been prompted by this by seeing a recent podcast from a BBC podcast from Esther Ranson about euthanasia. And what he reflected on is that no one seems to ever talk about the Rubicon that is crossed when euthanasia is legalized. Prior to legalization, everyone's life is protected by law, irrespective of your age, your gender, your physical condition. But once a state legalizes it, it has to make an arbitrary decision as to who can be killed and who can't. And I need not say that every nation that has legalized it almost always with promises to tightly control its application has made it more widely available down the line. And he then goes on to talk about how this has been exposed in Canada when, the government has recently announced they've got a new three-digit kind of emergency line number for people for suicide prevention and emotional distress support services. And so Robert says, some in Canada will be persuaded by the state not to commit suicide, while others will find the state willing to kill them to save the bother. So I guess this is a question all about the incoherence or the supposed incoherence and tension between when legalizing euthanasia while also trying as a kind of government, as a country, to reduce suicide. Do you see that incoherence yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think it's something that we often take for granted, and we don't see how the suicide prevention activities that go on in society, how extraordinary they are. I mean, we just think it's completely normal. But actually, if you think about it, you know, every single healthcare professional is trained to recognize how to recognize the possibility that someone is at risk of suicide. And if you come to the conclusion, for instance, with someone in severe depression, that they're at risk of killing yourself, this is regarded as a medical emergency. You drop, it's equivalent almost to someone about to have a cardiac arrest. You drop everything, you get them into hospital. If necessary, they can be sectioned and you use the force of law to physically prevent them from committing suicide. This is accepted. And similarly, for instance, every policeman, every prison warder, every paramedic, you know, is trained in how to recognize the risk of suicide, what steps to take, you know. And we think it's completely reasonable that we risk the life of an incredibly valuable policeman to go scaling up, you know, on a bridge or a tower crane in order to stop someone destroying their own life and taking an autonomous decision. And we applaud that. We think it's right and proper. And one of the most bizarre things to me, examples of this, was Harold Shipman, who was one of the most prolific mass murderer in UK history, but who was also a GP, and who murdered many of his patients. When he was eventually caught up with and he was sentenced to life imprisonment, he was put on suicide watch in prison, and yet eventually he managed to evade the suicide watch and he killed himself in prison. And the prison then holds an inquiry as to what went wrong. You know, why was this mass murderer allowed to kill himself? So there is this absolutely hardwired devotion to preventing suicide in our society. Suicide prevention is regarded as, and suicides are seen as an enormous tragedy. And, you know, personally, I've been, you know, affected by a whole number of suicides of close friends or of the children of close friends, and the devastating consequences and the outpouring of grief which comes from someone who's taken their own life. And so one way I've sometimes described it is that suicide prevention or the fact that we as a society say that this is wrong, this is something we don't like, this is part of the glue that binds us all together as a society. And yet, what the existence of laws on assisted suicide and euthanasia is that they conceive of the idea that there is such a thing as a rational suicide. That yes, most suicides is something that we absolutely want to prevent, minimize, and if necessary, we will take draconian steps to stop someone killing themselves. But if it's irrational, but there is this separate category which we perceive of as a rational suicide. If you have a life that is not worth living, if you have hopeless and unbearable suffering, and now you wish, or if you know that you're dying of a terminal illness, now your wish to end your life suddenly changes. Now it becomes rational. And what's more, now we as a society have a duty to allow you to commit a rational suicide. So, you know, philosophically, we've now got two categories. We've got the suicide, which we think is absolutely wrong and abhorrent, and then we've got this separate exception. Now here, and of course, then the question is, well, what is a rational suicide? What are the grounds? And can we agree what they are? And what so far, the you know, if you look at the different legislatures around the world, they've all come to contradictory decisions about what a rational suicide represents. In Oregon, you just have to have 6 months to live, less than 6 months to live. It doesn't matter if you're in any pain at all. It doesn't matter if you have any distress, or but simply having less than 6 months to live means that if you want to commit suicide, it's an autonomous decision, it's rational. In the Netherlands, you have to have hopeless and unbearable suffering. You could be someone who's 25 with anorexia nervosa, but if your psychogenic suffering is of such intensity that the state or the authorities regard it as hopeless and unbearable, then it's rational for you to end your life.
Hmm. And as Robert points out in his question, there's a deep irony here that, you know, the argument that's often made quite strongly in favour of euthanasia is this idea about it's about empowering people and giving them autonomy over the end of their lives. What we're really saying is we're giving the state, not the individual, the state can decide who is allowed to kill themselves and who is not, who will be restrained by the coercive, punitive force of the state from killing themselves and who will be permitted or encouraged or facilitated. And that's actually an astonishing power to grant to a state force, to a government that has the kind of monopoly on violence, as is often said in political theory, to say actually you can decide when which people are allowed to die and which must be kept alive.
Well, of course, it's the state that sets the law, but actually it's the poor doctor, you know, who in the end has to exercise, quotes, clinical judgment. And that's, again, one of the irony, you know, the argument I've made is if you were going to choose a profession to be responsible for deciding who can kill themselves and then to do the deed, you know, the last profession you would choose is a profession that has dedicated itself to life. You know, much better to create a new cadre of euthanasiologists who are trained in killing people cleanly and effectively. But it's the poor blooming doctor who in the end is in the hot seat. They are the one who is supposed to exercise judgment. So they move out of the cardiac arrest procedure where they've been using all their skill to try and keep someone alive, and then they move into the next room where they try and assess, is this person genuinely wanting to kill themselves, and have they got rational reasons, and does it fit the law, and are they being coerced, in which case I'll sign the form and agree with them.
And try and stop their heart rather than restart it in many cases.
Quite.
I guess the question behind the question is, you know, we're pointing out the kind of incoherence, the lack of joined up thinking. You know, Justin Trudeau clearly doesn't see an issue between promoting at the same time and expanding access for Canadians experiencing mental health problems, having access to euthanasia systems delivered by a state-funded health system, at the same time as saying, I'm going to invest more money and improve Canadians experiencing emotional distress so they will have access to support services and be prevented from killing themselves. He doesn't see a contradiction. We do see a contradiction. Do you think wider society acknowledges that contradiction or that incoherence? And even if it exists, does it matter? Like, is it a fundamental kind of flaw that will bring the euthanasia movement tumbling down? Or do you think actually the Western world is going to carry on with this glaring contradiction for many, many decades to come, no problem at all?
And it's a fascinating phenomenon, which I've come across and continue to come across repeatedly. And that is how in a society, and often with philosophers, thinkers, ethicists, opinion formers who regard themselves as highly educated, thoughtful, rational people, and yet they end up supporting two options which seem to be completely logically incoherent. And there will be many people who would say, what's the problem? You know, we completely support suicide prevention for all this category of people, and we completely support assisted suicide. What's the problem? And I see this repeatedly. So, I mean, another area where most people, if you ask them, would say, yes, we absolutely support the right of disabled children. We think the disabled people should be given the absolutely greatest right, you know, exactly equal rights to everyone else. Oh, and yes, we completely support the fact that all fetuses are screened in order to detect abnormalities, and parents are completely free to destroy disabled children if it's diagnosed before birth. And when you say, isn't that logically incoherent? They say, oh, I can't see your problem. I mean, it's about choice, isn't it? And freedom. And so, and there are many other examples of this, and so much so that I've come to sort of almost recognize this logical incoherence as a phenomenon of our modern age. It seems to be a kind of distorted thinking processes, which is characteristic of modernity.
And I guess in the past, I've hoped, wished, imagined, presumed that some of the absurdity of some of these, you know, in the extreme ends, you know, to use your example, you know, you could take a disabled child that is 39 weeks and 6 days old and a disabled child that is 40 weeks and 1 day old. And the only difference between them is that one is currently inside a womb as one is currently inside an incubator, and say, can it possibly make sense that the state says that the child in the womb, you're free to murder at will, and the child in the incubator will be protected at the cost of millions of pounds from any threat whatsoever to their life? Like, some of these contradictions seem so absurd that I've often hoped that they will collapse under the weight of their own incoherence. That there's a house, we've built a house of cards, but it can't last. And eventually, even our increasingly secular societies will wake up to the nonsense of some of our ethical decision-making. But I'm less convinced of that now. I'm now wondering, actually, as you say, is this just a symptom of how we live? And actually, human beings are remarkably good at self-deception if it suits their needs. And so I'm less confident now that these incoherencies, these contradictions are inevitably doomed. Actually, I see no reason why in 100 years' time, Canada is quite likely to still be simultaneously pursuing strong suicide prevention efforts for some mentally ill people and strong euthanasia encouragement for other mentally ill people. I'm less convinced that these will collapse under the weight of their own contradictions.
I think you're right. And I too, you know, as a younger and possibly more naive person, had similarly thought, all you've got to do is point out the contradiction and then people will say, oh, for goodness sake, I never saw this. You know, how foolish I've been. Now what I've discovered often from personal experience is that when you point out the contradiction, people just look at you slightly puzzled and say, okay, and why is that a problem? And I think when you unpick it, it's because fundamentally they have a prior faith commitments. So let's just take the abortion example. Most right-thinking liberal people, you know, from the age of 14, 15 onwards, decide that a liberal abortion policy allowing women to exercise choice is just what every right-thinking person agrees. It's a faith commitment. I don't actually think about the logic of it, the logical coherence. It's a primary commitment. Free abortion is a woman's right. I support it. And then you say, newborn baby in incubator, should we care for it? Absolutely. It's a faith commitment. Every baby deserves the very best possible treatment. I don't really think about it. It's a faith commitment. And then you point out, hang on a minute, you've got two faith commitments and here they suddenly collide in a most alarming way. Does that worry you? And they go, no, because they're both faith commitments and I can't give way on either of those. So I'm going to have to live with the contradiction.
I guess one example where I think there have been similar kind of contradictory faith commitments that collide, that have started to collapse under the contradiction in a much more recent era, this has taken us in a dangerous place, but it would be the trans debate, where, you know, 5 or so years ago, it was a faith commitment that trans women are women end of story, and they have all the same rights as natal females, and yet at the same time we believe that women should have protected spaces and be free from discrimination, blah 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 blah. And that was, for a few years, that was that kind of uneasy incoherence held, and lots of public institutions across society held both these things to be true. And I feel like in recent years, actually under sustained campaigning from kind of gender critical feminists and some, you know, Christians and kind of social conservatives, has forced sports bodies and governments and prison services to actually acknowledge there are competing faith commitments here. Our desire for kind of equality and liberty for trans people and our desire to protect, you know, safe spaces for women sometimes are in conflict. And we're now having to do the kind of messy job of relitigating all of that. Does that give you any confidence that the similar contradictions and incoherence in the issues around euthanasia or abortion could somehow, with lots of hard work and campaigning, also kind of be brought to light?
I mean, it's a fascinating world, and you know, these are rapidly changing, isn't it? I too, like you, have felt that in some way there is a sort of a movement which is pushing back against one's particular faith commitment in the transgender field. But it's by no means universal. And I'm not sure what the ultimate, you know, this is the extraordinary state of modern political life, isn't it? Of social, political development. And I mean, I often end up, you know, in a sort of slightly facile way of saying, you know, we live in a very confused and confusing world. You know, people are intensely confused. They have, because they have these competing faith commitments, and they're trying to make sense of them, and yet it really doesn't fit. And we as Christians need to be honest and say, yes, we too, sometimes it feels like we have competing faith commitments. We have a faith to the biblical truth as it is outlined in the Bible. And yet, if we're absolutely honest, you know, we also have I have a faith commitment to science and to truth in a scientific technological environment, and sometimes I'm struggling with how these different commitments, it's a very confusing world in which God has placed us. Ultimately, I believe it is, you know, all truth is God's truth, and ultimately we will through his power find a coherent understanding of this very confusing world, but it's work in progress.
And it may be that we'll only really live in that kind of that society of truth and coherence in the life to come, and maybe we'll always be living in the kind of contradictions and the inconsistencies until Jesus returns. We'll probably have to draw it a close there before we drift off even further off the point, but thank you very much, Robert and Joan, for your questions and prompting such interesting conversation. And as a reminder that we'd love to see more questions coming in from listeners, so do email us, molad@premier.org.uk. Also, don't forget, you can find lots of interesting resources to read, listen to, and watch on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Should know that one off by heart by now, shouldn't I? And a cheeky reminder that you can follow my own Substack newsletter called The Critical Friend. It's tswyatt.substack.com. That's a weekly roundup of some interesting church news, my own kind of commentary and analysis on that, and a smorgasbord of links and other things to, if you're interested in that world. So do sign up there. It's free, but you can also, if you'd like, if you appreciate what I'm doing, you can sign up to pay for it as well. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another episode next week. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.